This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Well, if you were hoping for a clean election with a clear, decisive outcome on who America's president will be, you've got to be disappointed and a bit concerned this morning. It's good to have you with us this Wednesday morning. I'm Joel Hilliker. This is our Trumpet Hour post-election special. We have quite a lot to discuss, and we really do want to give you the Trumpet's unique perspective, a biblical perspective on what's happening here. I'm joined in the studio this morning by Andrew Miller and Dwight Falk.
Greetings.
Appreciate you joining us. We also have Richard Palmer from our office in Britain. We're going to be talking to him in a bit for some European perspective on what's happening here. America is in a deadlock in several ways. It really is like there are two countries here in total ideological disagreement. This election showed this division isn't going away anytime soon. It showed just how much the two sides are digging in for this battle. And literally, with the election, we're in a deadlock with the results. The presidency is still a toss-up. Congress remains divided. A lot of people agree that it looks like the Democrats are going to keep the House. Republicans will keep the Senate. But their leads in those two houses will be narrower. You have at least several states that haven't finished their counts, so there could be a lot of ugly fights in the days ahead. Nevada says it's not going to give any more results till tomorrow. Wisconsin, Michigan, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, all of them still have votes to count. It's a really unusual situation because of the coronavirus changing the election rules in a lot of these states, creating this flood of mailed ballots. The U.S. Elections Project says more than 65 million people voted by mail this year. Now, in Pennsylvania, Donald Trump held a 13.4-point lead with 64% of the votes counted, but the state Supreme Court, now these justices are elected and they have a Democrat majority. They ruled that mail-in ballots received up to 3 days after Election Day have to be counted. They can't be rejected even if they don't have a clear Election Day postmark, or the signature doesn't even match the one on record for the voter, which is just inviting fraud. And it seems like the president's lead is big enough it would be hard for Joe Biden to overcome that, but it's concerning. They know exactly how many votes they have to get, and they can still put ballots in the box here for a while. In North Carolina, Donald Trump held a 1.4% lead with 94% of the votes counted. But that state's going to continue counting postmarked mail ballots as late as November 12th. That's next Thursday. Nevada will accept mailed ballots until November 10th. So it is a very, very unusual situation that has a lot of people concerned. Last night, Donald Trump, he gave a speech saying that he's won the election, and he tweeted this: "We're up big, but they are trying to steal the election. We will never let them do it. Votes cannot be cast after the polls are closed." And Twitter actually posted a warning label on that tweet. It said, "Some or all of the content shared in this tweet is disputed and might be misleading about an election or other civic process." So that gives you an idea just in and of itself how hotly contested this could be. The legal battles have already started. Republicans are filing a number of lawsuits. There are a couple of cases scheduled to be heard about Pennsylvania today. So it gives you an idea of just how ugly things could get. Now, the election process in America, it's just critical that Americans be able to trust that the process is clean and fair in order to trust the result. So I want to just open it up for a bit of discussion. Maybe we can start with you, Andrew. There's a lot of concern over voter fraud leading up to this election. I think I was seeing a lot of reports of inconsistencies and irregularities. We had talked about that Project Veritas expose down in Texas. A lot of signs that are upsetting people and getting people anxious about how fair this election is. In your view, how legitimate are those concerns, and what does this tell you about the state of American democracy.
Right. Well, we've definitely already seen several examples of voter fraud. There's always a little bit each election, and it seems like there's definitely getting more attention. Is probably much more prevalent this election with, like I said, Project Veritas has done a couple different undercover exposés. One of the more shocking ones, I'd written an article for back in October for The Trumpet in Minnesota, where they had especially association with Ilhan Omar's campaign, who did win re-election to the House, where they had like ballot harvesting, where they had someone from the Somali community up there who had 300 absentee ballots that he was turning in for that people he'd collected these from. They signed them, gave them to him, and then he took them to the polls. Well, and the law said that you can only use up to three. You can only turn in ballots for yourself and like two other people in Minnesota. I've also heard a few cases from Texas where they've got 100,000 ballots there that had some questions about were they actually postmarked correctly. But I think the biggest thing people are concerned about in terms of stealing the election is actually the deadlines for these mail-in ballots. Because in the United States, the only federally imposed deadline is the December 14th deadline when the Electoral College meets. All the state deadlines are mandated by individual state law. And it varies from state to state. Like in Wisconsin and Michigan, which are both look like they're going to be important swing states this election, the law states that you have to have your ballot in by an election day. Even if you do a mail-in ballot, it needed to be in yesterday. If it comes today, that's not how the law works there. That's your problem.
Which makes sense.
Right.
That seems like that should be the law really across the board.
It would make things a lot easier if it was across the law, across the board. But as you mentioned earlier, in Pennsylvania, it's different. You can your ballot can arrive Friday of this week, and it'll still count. Actually, in North Carolina, your ballot can arrive not this Thursday, but next Thursday, and it still counts. Now, the tricky part is, like, now obviously we know the deadline for each state, but there's already been moves to try to change the deadlines. Like, right coming up to the close to the election, both Wisconsin and Pennsylvania tried to change the deadline that they can come in. And the Supreme Court had to rule in both cases, actually. And they were controversial decisions. Amy Coney Barrett wasn't on the court yet. So it was an 8 Supreme Court. So John Roberts was the tie-breaking vote in both cases. And he ruled that it's like, okay, well, according to Wisconsin law, yeah, the Wisconsin courts are right. It does have to be in an election day. But according to Pennsylvania law, you do have those extra 3 days. But the details of those cases got fuzzy, and it looks like with as contested as this election is, there's going to be more court cases like that, even right. Trying to change the mail-in vote deadline after the fact, which is similar to what you had in the 2000 Bush v. Gore recount, where I forget which justice it was, but he said it might not be a good idea to change the rules of the game after the game is over. Yeah. He said maybe we could have talked about this if you would have done this court case before the election, but it's like, so we can't change it after the game's over. So if those cases do go up to the Supreme Court after the election, which is likely, now you've got 9 justices on the Supreme Court. Amy Coney Barrett's been confirmed, although there's a lot of Democrats who obviously don't like her. And I think even Nancy Pelosi has already come out last night and said Amy Coney Barrett is an illegitimate justice because the Senate pushed her through before the election. So that could get dicey.
it seems like what we have seen from the left in America, and we've talked so much about this at the Trumpet, is this spirit of whatever it takes, the law be hanged. Like they know what they want to get for an outcome, and they really don't care about the law. And really, when you go back, you mentioned the 2000 race with Bush v. Gore, and just how that pushed the country in a direction that it had not been before, in terms of just the level that that the Democrats were willing to, the steps that they were willing to take in order to try to win that election, even through the courts, through the lawyers, in whatever it would take. And you heard even, say, like those Project Veritas exposés, you had Democrat leaders who were saying that they would be willing to do whatever it took to get the outcome that they desired. But it really does, to go back to what we wrote about at the time in 2000, Gerald Flory wrote, I think it was our December 2000 issue, that the cover was The Rule of Lawyers. Gerald Flory's From the Editor was called The Real Election Crisis. And he made some really strong statements about the dangers of elections being decided by lawyers, which is exactly what the Democrats were trying to do at that time. He said, when America's forefathers established the Constitution, they told us it would work only if we were a law-abiding people. He said, there's deep bitterness between the two parties. It's growing worse by the day. No leader can lead such a deeply divided people in a democracy. But too many of our people exalt leaders who maneuver around the law instead of those who passionately keep it. This is another sign of our rotting morality. He said, like, that Florida vote scandal is going to poison our political system more than any other scandal at the time, because he said, this corrosive process is so deeply entrenched, it will continue from one election to the next. It's tearing our political system apart. Stephen Flory's been talking about just how much the Democrats have been preparing themselves for this, by, you know, talking about how it's going to be it's going to be a long time before this is decided. It's going to, you know, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty because of all of these mail-in ballots. They've gotten themselves ready for it, don't you think?
Oh, I think, yeah, definitely. And it's interesting to me. I think looking back at 2000, they learned some things, right? The Democrats in particular. And I think what they learned is maybe you need to slow the process down a little earlier. Because once you get momentum going that somebody's won, it's harder to reverse thought on that. And I think they did a good job, or whoever was involved, of just putting it on ice last night around 10 o'clock Eastern time, to where it was like, well, we're done counting for today. And, right. And my thought, we were talking about this, and my thought was, why? Why stop now? And, you know, I was thinking even about sports. If you have a review policy in sports, a call goes one way, you want to review it, they always talk about, well, whatever call was made, it's very hard to overturn it and to go the other direction.
Yeah.
And so here we're in a situation where, okay, let's stop counting and let's just get the legal system involved, it seems like to me. And so it seems like that's a very specific strategy.
Yeah.
At least that's the way it looks at this time. I mean, because we were talking about it before we came on the air, and you know, I said, like, I can order a package from Amazon, and it could be in my front yard tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow we can't count votes past 10 o'clock Eastern time. Right. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, you can see that they've already got the law teams geared up. They've got literally thousands of lawyers for the Biden campaign, and probably quite a few lawyers for the Trump campaign, ready for these litigations. And I was looking, actually, one of the lead lawyers who's going to be doing the litigation of this election for the Biden campaign is Mark Elias, who works for the law firm Perkins Coal, but he's made himself a name as he worked for the Hillary Clinton campaign. He's the man who paid Christopher Steele for his Russia dossier. So I guess that's just showing you the level of character and the lawyers they've chosen to lead this is this man's his last big project was paying Ukrainian lawyers to make false accusations that President Trump was involved in prostitutes and illegal business deals to get him impeached unlawfully. And then they're like, okay, well, that's the guy. That's the guy we want representing us or leading this forward to try to change some of these deadlines for when the mail-in ballots can come in or can't come in or how long we have to wait before – like when is the – trying to decide basically when is the election actually over. Was it over yesterday, or is it over Friday, or is it over next Thursday, or can they be accept mail-in ballots?
Well, and that's the thing that jumps out to me about all of the, you know, the laws about when these ballots can come in. That might be fine, but why stop counting what you have? It's like they've used that idea that, well, we don't have to have them all in until a certain date to not count what's already there. And why not count what's there?
I do feel like they were laying the groundwork for that with the kinds of objections that they were putting up because of coronavirus and emphasizing so much how important it was to get the mail-in ballots. They, you know, changed these deadlines in advance of this. They put in a lot of work to give themselves these relief valves in a way. And I, you know, ordinarily, it's not like looking at these things just in and of themselves. It's not like, well, there's clearly nefarious activity going on here. But when you put it in the context of the kinds of behaviors that we have seen, Stephen Fleury's drawn attention to that quote from his father many times, where he says, we've seen just how far the left is willing to go in order to cling to power. You can't view what these decisions that are being made in isolation, right. You have to see it in the context of this larger narrative that has been playing out where they really are willing to do whatever it takes.
Yeah, and that's the bizarre thing about it is you have this legal structure, which is potentially being manipulated on some level. But it's built upon a foundation of we want our candidate to win no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing that I mentioned at the beginning that really stands out to me is we've almost grown accustomed to having these kinds of like existential problems that result from the division within America. The idea that you really have two camps who are as far apart as they could possibly be. This is not a normal situation, and it's not a healthy situation. I think there's a lot of discussion as if division is healthy. And I think we see more and more in this country that it is a curse. You can't view it as anything other than a curse. I mean, I think about the that passage that we go to fairly often in Isaiah 1, where it talks about America being a sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, and they've forsaken the Lord and provoked God to anger. They're gone away backward. He's pointing to the sin of the nation that we're laden, just weighed down with sin that's causing these kinds of curses. And it says there, the whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. You definitely see this sickness in the left in America, but God says the whole head is sick. There's something really wrong with the nation's heart. It says it's sick from the top of the head down to the toe, and full of wounds and bruises and so on. It's just a diseased state, and I think people don't even know what a healthy community looks like. They think division is healthy. They think dissent is healthy, but it's not. It really is a sickness. You know, if everything is functioning well together and working harmoniously, that's health. That's a healthy body, and that's not what you see in America. I do want to just turn our attention over to Richard for a bit, because he
He's been following just what has been coming out of European news sites, other nations. I mean, to me, this is a really important aspect of what we see happening here. America is meant to be, you know, the example nation of this particular form of Republican government. And these kinds of problems that have become just so enmeshed in our overall political system, we are taking these things for granted. But I think it is worth stepping out and looking at what other nations see when they look at America. And the reality is what they see isn't something that they feel like following the example of. So let's go to Richard. So what are you seeing on the European front as they watch what's happening here?
It's like looking at American politics through one of those funfair type mirrors, you know, that's got the curved surface, say, and distorts it. There's reality in that mirror, but then you get a very distorted version of that reality. I think if you are somebody living in Europe, watching what is happening in America right now via your European media, there's a real chance that you're going to move forwards from this thinking Donald Trump is basically Robert Mugabe. you know, that is the kind of picture that European politicians and European media is painting of what is happening in the United States. You know, there was a senior Green politician in Germany, their transatlantic spokesman. He said that this was an unprecedented attack on American democracy. This was President Trump claiming victory this morning, which... I mean, I can think of a pretty big attack on American democracy that happened about 80 years ago, and if I remember correctly, Germany was pretty heavily involved in that. So to have a German politician come out and talk about unprecedented attacks on democracy because of a speech is pretty rich. But he's not the only one. Germany's Green Party leader in Parliament, they've called for the EU Council to hold an emergency meeting on how Europe should respond to what's happening, on how all votes should be cancelled. There's a senior German politician, Martin Schulz. He said that we in Europe are one of the last bastions of parliamentary democracy. So, you know, America's no longer a democracy now. They've got an authoritarian that is taking charge. I think one of the worst articles of this came from Spiegel, where they said that Donald Trump was turning the vote into a farce. He said, but this article says, democracy in the United States has long been regarded as the great shining example for many countries around the world. No longer. And then it talked about President Trump's speech this morning and what he was doing. And it said it is grotesque, absurd, and anti-democratic. It says Trump doesn't care one iota about adhering to the norms that constitute a functioning democracy. Since becoming president, he has piece by piece destroyed faith in his country's democratic institutions. And basically the whole message of this is that Donald Trump is an authoritarian and he's taking control. And actually both Spiegel and Bill today were running stories basically saying that President Trump is a psychopath. They both had this is Spiegel, scientist, Trump reveals dictator mentality. Sorry, this is Bild, Germany's biggest mass circulation newspaper. They said, they quote this professor from the University of Tübingen and talking to the Dusseldorf Rheinland Post, you know, saying that he is creating desired realities and facts to enthrone oneself as the winner before the count. Here, the dictator mentality reveals itself, not that of a democratic politician. And you know, Spiegel had something very similar. So that's the message coming from Europe. Donald Trump is a dictator that is trying to take over America.
Well, there are nations that... it was interesting last night. I was watching... Somebody was talking about how the yuan was going down and Chinese markets were going down because they were actually looking at what was happening in the election, and it looked like Donald Trump was actually going to win. So there was this reaction that the tariffs that he's imposed on China were actually going to stick around. So it seems like those nations that are anti-Trump, that there really was some level of concern that he was going to win. It seems like those have leveled out, and some of the pro-Biden sentiment has risen to some degree. They're kind of whipping back and forth as these narrow, thin margins are swapping back and forth. But you also have nations And some of them are in Europe who are actually quite pro-Trump. I think Israel is certainly one that would be very much for a Trump victory. There are some in Europe who look at Trump as being really their one saving factor from the reach of the EU bureaucracy.
And Russia, crazily enough, given that the main message from the U.S. media is that Donald Trump is in Vladimir Putin's pocket. I mean, a lot of Eastern European countries view Donald Trump as their savior from Russia because he will stand up to Russia when President Obama did not. So, yes, Slovenia, their leader already put out a tweet congratulating President Trump on his victory. He said it's pretty clear the American people have elected Donald Trump for four more years, more delays and facts denying from the mainstream media. Anyway, just going on and putting out this congratulation. He got very swiftly condemned by the rest of the EU, but Poland is also very, very pro Mr. Trump because of some of what he's been doing, canceling the Nord Stream pipeline and things like that. So, sure, there are plenty, especially within Eastern Europe. I think Boris Johnson would probably be – there's been a lot of ongoing debate as to how – what would be better for Britain. But it does seem like it's going to be much easier for Britain to leave the European Union and do a trade deal with a President Trump in charge than it would be a President Biden. So definitely some in support. But the picture, I guess, I'd say that the main anti-American picture is coming out of Germany. Germany, France, Belgium, some of these other countries, but Germany by far, I think, is the one that has the most negative portrayal of President Trump.
Well, I was talking about this this split in America where it's almost like two completely different worldviews that you see vying for dominance within the country. And the worldview of the left is very much in alignment with the worldview of the European bureaucrats and those who want this more globalist system. They loved Barack Obama because he was on board with that, trying to bring American dominance down a few pegs to make it more of a partner among equals in the world. And Joe Biden definitely represents that same kind of spirit. So you could definitely see why they would be much happier with a Biden presidency than with the America First presidency of a Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that a lot of those people, they're responding by saying, well, we need to push harder in the face. If President Trump does win, we need to go for a full European Union so we can stand up to him. I imagine if Biden won, they would take that as encouragement for a much closer European Union as well. But Martin Schulz, he was a former candidate to be German chancellor. He said that should Trump stay in office for another 4 years, Europe would have to unite. And then Guy Verhofstadt said something similar, the former Belgian prime minister, saying, looking at the chaos across the Atlantic, I'm more certain than ever that Europeans are stronger together in an uncertain world, which, I mean, the way Europe chooses its three presidents, if they're criticizing America for not being democratic, at least America has an election for its president. I don't think Europe has elections for any of its 3 to 5 different presidents. But you can see that their answer to whatever the question is, more Europe. But they certainly definitely want to move forwards with that kind of same left-wing vision of the Paris Climate Change Accords and all of those things that did harm America. They want to push forward with that even faster now. There is this increasing sense, really, in Europe that America is a foe. And senior leaders have said that over the last year or two. President Trump has even said that about Europe. But I think, assuming President Trump remains in office following forwards from this election, I think you'll see a dramatic escalation in that enmity between Europe and the United States, especially pushing this narrative of that Donald Trump is a dictator now.
Well, there are a lot of prophetic trends that we're looking at to give us a sense of what direction this election and the nation is going to take moving forward. And it's interesting to consider how this relationship between Europe and America, which we've talked a lot about over the years, and this rift in this transatlantic relationship, is another one that you can consider. Like, I would think that would just in the knowing that prophecy, that we would probably see that intensify, that it speaks to the possibility or the probability of Donald Trump pulling this election out yet. Well, thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're talking about America's elections yesterday. Coming up, we're going to have a bit more discussion, including some of the other results from this election, besides just the presidential race. So stick around.
Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. You people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Obviously, most of the attention was riveted on the presidential race, but there were a whole lot of other elections going on, a whole lot of other items on the ballots. And so we want to just spend some time looking at some of those other things. We're going to start by just looking at some of the congressional races. The overall picture, it looks like it's pretty well locked where it was, as I mentioned before, that the Republicans will probably hold on to the Senate. The Democrats hold on to the House with slimmer margins of error on both sides. Very interesting. Let's talk about some of the specific races that we saw that give us a pretty good idea of where America is moving politically, at least in some parts of the country. Dwight, any that you noticed?
Well, everything is very much tied, as we've been talking about, you know, in the Senate, I guess, at this point still. And although they've already said that, I guess, the House is going to stay with the Democrats, although right. I'm still looking at the votes coming in, and I'm not sure. I guess they project ahead. I don't know.
Yeah, they called that pretty early.
Really early on, and even now I've just been looking at it, and unless they know something that I don't know, which they probably do, I'm still not sure why they're calling that so early. But
yeah, I had the same thought where Nancy Pelosi announced pretty early that, like, oh, well, we've held the House, and there were a lot of votes not counted, which she may well be right on that, but it struck me as ironic that they President Trump's got so much criticism for saying, it's like, well, I probably won the presidential election. Well, at the same time, Nancy Pelosi's pretty much the same thing. She's like, well, we probably kept the House.
Yeah, I thought it was when I heard that, and then I looked at the results that were coming through on different polls. I was kind of rubbing my eyes, like, what am I missing here? Right. What intel am I not aware of?
Well, apparently, all of the members of what's called the Squad were reelected. This very radical group that is in the House of Representatives, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, they won. I saw in Missouri there was a Black Lives Matter activist, Cori Bush, who won. She became Missouri's first black congresswoman. She got 84% of the vote in Missouri's first congressional district. And this woman had the backing of the Justice Democrats. That's the political action committee that helped Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez win 2 years ago. It said that this woman may become the fifth member of the Squad. So some good BLM support in Missouri. Apparently she entered the movement really right after everything blew up in Ferguson a couple of years back.
Yeah, it is. I guess probably shouldn't be surprising just how overt some of these more radical views are becoming. It seems like for most of Barack Obama's presidency, you definitely had progressive Democratic politicians who sympathized with groups like Black Lives Matter or the Muslim Association for America or the Democratic Socialist of America. But now and more and more, especially with the Squad, you're seeing people who are actual like card-carrying members of the Democratic Socialist America, or people who actually like identify as a member of Black Lives Matter, sitting in the chair. They don't have to. It's like I don't have to sympathize with the Democratic Socialist America, because like, I'm an actual member. In the case of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And then, yeah, she's got this new fifth member who's an actual member of Black Lives Matter.
You know, I, to me, it speaks to the wisdom of the way that the founders set up the country. That you have the House is meant to be this kind of direct representation from America. All of these districts that are all over the country, where you may have like a fairly high concentration of a kind of extreme position, and they may be able to send someone like an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or a Cori Bush to the House of Representatives. They're there for 2 years. If they're going to stay, they've got to preserve that support. But it's this kind of rowdy, raucous. The House of Representatives is like, you know, who knows what's going to end up there. But it also speaks to the wisdom of the Electoral College, that you can't have overrepresentation on the parts of these pockets of support, that you have to have this. You have to put together a broad coalition of Americans in order to have the highest office in the land, which that there's a lot of wisdom in that when you see people like AOC and Cori Bush going to Washington.
When the Black Lives Matter member there was giving a speech, the thing that struck me was all the banners behind them, the BLM banners and flags, and I just thought I don't remember anyone representing the United States having like sort of a separate flag.
Yeah,
they're representing sort of a it's like a different country almost.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was odd to see. It was like something out of a weird dystopian movie or something. But I didn't see any American flags. I just saw BLM everywhere you could see behind them.
You were also looking at a race in Delaware for Senate.
Yeah, that's right. That's one that's, again, something that's unique this time. Delaware has elected Democrat Sarah McBride. That would make her the first openly transgender state senator in the country's history when she is sworn in. So
a state senator.
State senator. Yeah.
Big news out of Oklahoma as well. Mari Turner is going to be the first Muslim lawmaker in Oklahoma. 27-year-old black, queer, progressive newcomer just made history in Oklahoma. She won her election for the House in Oklahoma's 88th district. Making history as the first Muslim person elected to the state's legislature. But also, this individual goes by the pronouns they and she. This is a press release from the LGBTQ Victory Fund. Today, LGBTQ Victory Fund endorsed candidate Marie Turner, won their race for the Oklahoma State House, became the first openly non-binary person ever elected to a state legislature in the United States. The president for this group, the president and CEO, released this statement: of all the states to achieve a milestone political moment for non-binary people, few would have thought it would be Oklahoma, where there are so few LGBTQ elected officials. But Maury ran a tireless campaign focused on the issues that matter to their district while also being authentic and open to who they are. These pronouns really get confusing. Maury is now a trailblazer for non-binary people, and their courage to run openly will inspire more non-binary people to pursue careers in elected office.
It really just highlights something that was even brought out in the No Freedom Without Law booklet from 2000. Just the fact that you see chaos in politics in America. And even on this level now, it's just more chaos. The law is pretty confusing, right, when you start to get into some things in terms of like the law of the land and how things work. And now we don't even know how to address someone. I mean, really, I don't mean that to be like a flippant joke or something. I just mean it's just more chaos and more confusion where like, okay, how do you want to be addressed? And can we even get to the business of the day here? We've got to work our way through all of your personal agendas before we can even get to the business of the state or the country. So it's just more chaos and it's more confusion, and it just seems to be snowballing in that direction.
We do have a few that didn't have to do with individuals elected. I saw a report showing that Oregon became the first state to decriminalize hard drugs like heroin and cocaine. Possession of a small amount of drugs is decriminalized. The Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act will transition their drug policy from a punitive criminal approach to, quote, a humane, cost-effective health approach. So they're going to be treated with health care services rather than criminal punishments. This is the language of the bill. A health care approach includes a health assessment to figure out the needs of people who are suffering from addiction, and it includes connecting them to the services they need. So instead of putting them in jail, they're going to offer addiction services funded by marijuana tax revenue. So this is more than $100 million a year in the state.
Wow.
That's going to be put toward that. Oregon.
Well, and then South Dakota, too. They passed their Amendment 8 to legalize marijuana. Legalizes the recreational use of marijuana for individuals 21 years old and older, and they can possess or distribute up to 1 ounce. That was close. 53.4% said yes.
Well, they saw marijuana being legalized in so many other states and saw what a spectacular success that was in improving the health of their citizenry,
right?
And eliminating the problem of police brutality and that type of thing.
But what's so interesting? Now, Herbert Armstrong talked for years about how one of the difficulties with marijuana is a stepping stone drug. And so what are we talking about today exactly?
Right.
Let's take the money we make in marijuana and then fund all these other drug recovery programs, which we know are probably not going to help more people, but actually take away the fear of getting caught with these illegal drugs, these harder drugs. So it's just stepping more and more in that direction.
Right. Actually, I think I saw that it's not just the South Dakota, but also Arizona and New Jersey legalized marijuana in some form this election, which I think that brings it up to 11 states total that have like full legalization of marijuana. And then if you look at like partial legalization, it would be a majority of the states. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I know it's more than half.
Yep.
And for the thing about South Dakota, I think that's unique from what I've read, is that they pass both they legalize both medical and recreational at the same time.
Right.
Usually they do kind of a stepping stone, and here it was just like, nah.
Well, it's one of those things that once you move that direction, you never hear of a state saying, we made a mistake, let's back up. We've seen the fruits of this policy. Let's get things back on track. Once it's done, it's done.
Yeah.
Right, because this was like a really controversial issue just a few elections ago. And now, like I said, you're to a point where over half the states have legalized it in some form. And then, like you're saying, now you've got one state just sticking its toe in the water, going like, well, we've legalized the marijuana for so long now. Why don't we just like do all drugs?
I was going to say, well, that's a great point, because it's easy to forget how controversial some things were just not long ago.
Right.
And now it's so commonplace, it doesn't even move the meter in terms of controversy.
The pace of change is very fast. Another issue that came up on at least one state ballot was abortion.
Yeah, in Colorado, they were trying to put some limits on abortions, and that didn't pass. So you can continue to have abortions beyond, I believe it's a 22-week limit. That's kind of what they were looking at. And so trying to put at least some limits on what people can do, and that was rejected. So just a lot of things that, again, they're just lawless, I mean, to be frank about it. And in terms of the depravity in the country, it's just escalating. You would hope that people would say, well, let's put an end to some of these things or cut it off at some point. But like we've been talking about, once you get that ball rolling, where does it stop? Mm-hmm. And that's the same point that Gerald Fleury brings out in that No Freedom Without Law, is that, look, we lost the war on drugs. We everything we keep losing, all these wars on any sort of moral battle, and where does it end? It doesn't end until your whole society collapses around you.
Well, I guess this is the result of a democracy, that when you have the people who are deciding their own what they want, then like I think Orson Scott Card said, if pigs could vote, the man with the slop bucket would be elected swineherd every time, no matter how much slaughtering he did on the side. What the people want, that's what they get. And you know, even when it's not done on the national level, when you see these pockets of this kind of thinking taking root within the states, it's just a matter of time. Just to go back to that section in Isaiah 1, this is exactly what God is talking about when he says that it's a hypocritical nation that's laden with iniquity. So definitely see the direction that that America is taking with those kinds of rulings. Well, we'll leave the discussion off there. And we'll take a short break, and we'll come back in just a moment with the last word for today.
Do you believe the United States of America has been mainly a positive force in the world for most of its history? Do you believe that America was at one time a great nation? The United States of America was founded on many biblical principles that were incorporated into the Constitution. This lent to its success and positive influence in the world. But the America of then is not the America of today. To anyone examining the current state of America, this should be alarming. It has been a great nation in time past and is experiencing a temporary resurgence in these end times, but it will only be exactly that, temporary. Our free booklet, Great Again, will explain America's status. It will prove that God has been intimately involved in the rise and resurgence of America under President Donald Trump. It will also explain why God is saving America temporarily, how he was doing it, and what is yet to come in America. There is a spiritual dimension to America's rise and decline as a superpower. This free booklet will explain this dimension and how God will soon make America truly great again. Request your free copy of our book, Great Again, at our website, thetrumpet.com.
It's time for today's last word.
Looking at the state of American politics today, it really makes you yearn for a new government, good government, perfect government. Jesus Christ instructed us to pray, "Thy kingdom come." And that prayer should become more urgent all the time. In the first century, just a few months after Jesus had been crucified, the Apostle Peter spoke to a huge crowd gathered at the temple in Jerusalem, and he said these words, "Repent you, therefore, and be converted, that your sins may be blotted out, when the times of refreshing shall come from the presence of the Lord, and he shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you, whom the heaven must receive until the times of restitution of all things, which God has spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began." All the prophets have been talking about this since the world began. In his booklet, God's Family Government, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, wrote, "God's prophets have known from the beginning that something was dangerously and fundamentally wrong on this earth. Throughout most of recorded history, these prophets have warned this world it was going in the wrong direction. But if we go back far enough, we see that the earth was full of joy, peace, and abundance. Then disaster struck. We must receive the restitution of all things to solve mankind's problems. The world is upside down and must be put right side up. What does this involve? A fundamental change in
government. That time is almost here. That transition from the governments of men to the government of God. Revelation 11 and verse 15 records this extraordinary, inspiring prophecy. And the seventh angel sounded, and there were great voices in heaven saying, "The kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever." The governments of this world will be replaced by the government of God. All of these governments that we see, the government of the United States, this bickering, divided government, is going to become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. The same is true of the Communist Party of China under Xi Jinping. He's going to become, that government will become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. Those communist leaders won't be in power anymore. The Islamist regime of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran is about to be deposed and stripped of its power. The regimes of Kim Jong-un in North Korea and Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey and Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, Vladimir Putin in Russia, Bashar al-Assad in Syria, they'll all become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. And that passage in Revelation 11 continues, "And the 24 elders which sat before the Lord on before God on their seats fell upon their faces and worshiped God, saying, 'We give you thanks, O Lord God Almighty, which are and were and are to come, because you have taken to you your great power and have reigned.'" God is going to take that power from man. He's going to strip man of all the power that he's had, and he's going to reign in his stead. He's going to show the true answers to the questions of government that have plagued mankind throughout history. He's going to stop the abuses and correct the injustices, and he's going to show man what good government looks like. That's really something that we can look forward to. And when we see the kind of chaos happening on the political scene today, it should really increase our enthusiasm to see that government take its place. You know, every now and then in this world, you see a dictator removed from power and humbled. We've seen that with even in, you know, recent decades with men like Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, Robert Mugabe. Well, that's exactly what's going to happen with all the kingdoms of this world. Now, the difference is that God has a plan still to reach those disgraced dictators and those discredited leaders. When Christ returns, when Satan is removed from his throne and people's eyes are opened, they're really going to grasp the most important lessons of these last 6,000 years. This is what the prophet Jeremiah said about this time in Jeremiah 16. "O eternal, my strength and my fortress and my refuge in the day of affliction, the Gentiles shall come unto you from the ends of the earth and shall say, 'Surely our fathers have inherited lies, vanity, and things wherein there is no profit.'" So people all over the world are going to realize that they've been taught lies. They've trusted men. They've put their faith in schemes. They've trusted charlatans. And they're going to be ready for a change. That passage in Jeremiah 16 continues, "Shall a man make gods unto himself, and they are no gods? Therefore, behold, I will this once cause them to know. I'll cause them to know my hand and my might, and they shall know that my name is the Eternal." People all over the earth are going to come to know the true God. He's going to show himself. He's going to show his might and his power and bring all people under his rule. You can read about this in the wonderful prophecy by the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 9:6. "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder." The government of God will rest on his shoulders, and he's not going to be a tyrant or a despot. That verse continues by saying, "His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." What wonderful titles. That's a magnificent picture of what a blessing his government will be.
it continues, of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth, even forever. The zeal of the Eternal of Hosts will perform this. God is zealous about this. Herbert W. Armstrong wrote, "The restoration of God's government is the one great purpose uppermost in God's mind." And you read so many prophecies about the world that God is going to establish under that government, and all the beauty and prosperity and happiness and joy of the wonderful world tomorrow springs from this, from God's government being established. As it says in Proverbs 29 verse 2, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked bear rule, the people mourn." God is about to turn a lot of mourning into rejoicing. This whole world coming under God's government will be a beautiful revolution. And we're going to be able to fully understand and appreciate all the lessons of bad government that man has been writing for 6,000 years, and to realize fully just how much we need the government of God. What a blessing God's government really is. Well, I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I really want to thank my guests today, Andrew Miller, Dwight Falk, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to our technical staff, Bailey Crawford and Parker Campbell. And I'll leave you with this thought from James Freeman Clark. A politician thinks of the next election. A statesman thinks of the next generation. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.